So the Dhamma for today is the Noble Eightfold Path, the Arya Atangika Magga, the core of the Buddha's teaching, the essence or the framework on which we can base all of the teachings of the Buddha. The Noble Eightfold Path is what the Buddha taught in the beginning, it's what he taught at the end, it's what he taught as being the signature of the Buddha Sasana, the dispensation of the Buddha or all Buddhas. When he first taught at the beginning of his dispensation, he taught to these five ascetics who were torturing themselves. So the first thing he taught them was that torturing yourself is just an extreme. The first thing he taught was to avoid the two kinds of extreme practice, two kinds of practice that are unhelpful or harmful or that don't lead to freedom from suffering, don't lead to enlightenment. That is the engagement or obsession with sensual pleasure, chasing after or seeking out sensual pleasure. And the opposite of seeking out torture, seeking out pain, which may seem odd, but was at the time of the Buddha the logical conclusion for those who realized that sensual pleasure wasn't the source of true happiness or freedom from suffering. So when they realized that chasing after sensual pleasure just led to more suffering, more stress, more addiction, they decided to go in the opposite direction. They said if we torture ourselves, we'll free ourselves from this bondage to this addiction to sensuality, which of course didn't really work and didn't lead to any great or profound understanding. So the Buddha taught that these two extremes are not valid practices leading to enlightenment or freedom from suffering. And so the next thing he said is there is a middle way. There is a way to avoid the mistake of falling into either of these extremes. You can find a way in between them. And he said this is the Eightfold Noble Path. And this is what he continued to teach for 45 years. And before he passed away, he had one final conversion of this monk who had newly ordained, came and asked the Buddha for a brief teaching, and the Buddha said, so he asked the Buddha whether there are enlightened beings in all religions or whether all teachers are enlightened or that sort of thing. And the Buddha said that in whatever religion you find the Eightfold Noble Path, there you will find enlightened beings. So he said that this Eightfold Noble Path is the test, is the criteria. If a person is following the Eightfold Noble Path, then they are on the way to become enlightened and find freedom from suffering. So the word Arya should be familiar. It's a word that has had some negative connotations, but it has a lot of the same negative connotations that the word noble has. Of course, those who have called themselves noble by birth are often some of the worst and most egregious offenders in terms of ethics and morality and just general goodness. They tend to be, they have the potential to be corrupt and evil due to the spoiled nature of being born into luxury and wealth. But by the same token, the word noble as a general quality is still seen as something valuable, something positive, something good. And so the word Arya is the same. At the time of the Buddha it was, or before the Buddha, it had been used by those who were conquerors and violent war mongers who came to India to conquer and to control the lesser developed or less organized, less warlike people. We know that before this civilization there was a peaceful society in existence, but this group of invaders came and they used the word Arya. Arya means something like a conqueror or a victor, someone who overcomes their enemies. And so it actually is an apt word to be co-opted by the Buddha and used in a different way. But I think even at the time of the Buddha, it was already understood to be a word that just meant higher. So those people who were higher and controlling the indigenous population, but also over time became something a little bit less terrible, to just mean something like noble, something like higher, someone who is victorious, could be spiritually victorious. And so the Buddha used it in this sense. But we can remember back to the roots to understand that Arya means indeed one who has conquered the enemies. But in a spiritual sense, it means, of course, conquering the enemies inside of you. And our practice of the Buddha's teaching and cultivating clarity and insight is in many ways a war with the evil, unwholesome habits that we're stuck on, and that lead us to stress and suffering. So this is the word Arya. Atangika, there are eight parts. Magga means it's a path. So the path of the Buddha, the Arya Atangika Magga, or the Eightfold Noble Path, has to be understood, or has to be explained, in three parts. There's the two parts of the path, which means the path that we actually practice, all that we undertake from the moment you arrive at the center until the moment that you finish the course. Your practice is called the Pubanga Magga. It's the preliminary path. So what we call the Noble Path is actually technically just a moment. And why that is because there's only one moment that actually can be said to directly lead to the next moment, which is freedom from suffering. Our goal, our aim, is to enter into the experience of the cessation of suffering, where the mind lets go, and as a result of letting go, there is freedom. But that letting go is just in one moment. And so that moment where the mind lets go, that is called the path. It's called the path because the next moment the mind is free from the attachments to greed and attachments of greed and anger and delusion. At that moment, the mind has become released, not attaching to seeing or hearing or smelling or tasting or feeling or thinking, not attaching to the five aggregates or the body or the mind. The mind has let go. So that moment is called the path. And all of our practice is to lead up to that one point where we have a perfect moment where the mind sees things clearly as they are and sees that nothing is worth clinging to and experiences the Four Noble Truths. Seeing suffering and the cause of suffering and the cessation of suffering, and it's thereby the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. But the preliminary path, this is what we mostly talk about in terms of practice and how to attain the goal of freedom from suffering, it can also be broken up into two parts. There's the conceptual side of things in terms of talking about people or places or things, ideas, concepts, conventional reality. And then there's the side of ultimate reality, which is the momentary experiences that arise during the practice of insight meditation. So I'll talk about these three levels to give you an idea of the meaning behind each of the eight parts and how to put them into practice. So the first of the eight factors is called right view. Each of the factors has a rightness to it. And so the Eightfold Noble Path is the eight kind of rightnesses, as opposed to the eight kind of wrongnesses. Like eight wrong view, wrong this, wrong that. So right view means the absence of wrong view, and it also means the existence of seeing things clearly and as they are. View can also be understood as perspective, because part of it is going to be intellectual, but part of it is practical. Where you see things, the way you see things is your view, is your perspective. And this is the first one. This is from on a conceptual level, it's always the first step. In order to actually even want to cultivate insight meditation or want to see things clearly, you have to have a certain amount of right view. If you don't, if you come to practice meditation with wrong view, you of course won't reach the goal, you won't get anywhere near the goal of freeing yourself from suffering. For example, if someone comes to find pleasure or seeking out something that they can hold on to, then we have to dissuade them of this. We have to explain and help them understand that nothing is worth clinging to. And the Buddha said intellectually, this is the essence of what you have to accept to begin the practice of mindfulness. You don't have to understand it. You don't have to see it for yourself. But you have to know that this is the way the Buddha taught, that nothing is worth clinging to. If you understand that, if you understand what that means, and if you are interested in finding out the truth of that statement, then this is the beginning of right view. Of course, you need right view in terms of an understanding of karma, cause and effect. This is one of the first things that meditators gain, and something that intellectually is important. If you have no sense of right and wrong, your practice will fail, and many aspects of your practice will fail, as you'll be disinclined towards ethics. You'll find yourself not wanting to be, not having any interest or any ability to be ethical, if you don't understand the karma and the cause and effect nature of ethical and unethical deeds. So on a preliminary level, we have to understand intellectually, and we have to understand conceptually what right view is, that there is good deeds, there is bad deeds, that we should undertake good deeds like meditation, but also ethics and also charity, kindness. We need a lot of good qualities to support us in our practice. We need to be thoughtful and compassionate and caring and kind. All of these things are an important support for our cultivation of clarity. They help strengthen the mind and so on. If you don't understand this nature of cause and effect, if you don't have a sense of the truth of karma, then you'll engage in unwholesome actions, unwholesome speech, unwholesome thoughts, and your mind will be corrupted, your mind will be distracted, your mind will be weak, and you won't be able to see things as they are. But on a practical level, right view means seeing experiences as they are. So seeing the impermanence of experiences, seeing the suffering, and seeing the non-self. So the majority of our practice of insight meditation is for the purpose of seeing these three characteristics. And these comprise the essence of a mundane right view. In other words, what we practice before entering into the moment where we see things clearly as they are. Up until that moment, we're cultivating an understanding and a clarity, a vision of these three characteristics. Without practicing mindfulness, we tend to believe or expect things to be stable, looking for stability. Meditation is thought to be something that should be stable, and the idea is that we come to meditation with the idea that our meditation should be stable and satisfying and controllable. And so we complain often, meditators will often complain about how unstable their mind is, how unsatisfying the experiences can be, and how uncontrollable they are. They'll complain about how they're not able to control their mind, they'll complain about how they're not experiencing any more satisfaction or pleasure than before, and they'll complain how chaotic things can be. But this is the essence and the nature of experience, and so our practice of mindfulness is to understand this and appreciate the reality of this, rather than trying to change reality to become stable and satisfying and controllable. The practice of mindfulness is to change our perspective, so we don't need things to be the same. We don't need for things to satisfy us. Our happiness doesn't depend on the existence or the absence of certain experiences. And we don't need to control things in order to be at peace. We become independent. We don't cling and expect things to be a certain way, our body and our mind to be a certain way. Whatever experiences come, through the practice of mindfulness, our perspective changes. Our view becomes that nothing is worth clinging to, and that the way to freedom from suffering is not to change things, It's to stop needing for them to be a certain way, to experience reality just as it is. Reality continues on regardless of whether we want it to or want it not to. And so the only variable that is of any importance is our perspective, our view. This is the essence of the cultivation of right view. And then, of course, at the moment of the Arya Magga, there comes a moment where the meditator experiences with perfect clarity any one of the three characteristics is enough. At the moment of seeing things as they are, the meditator will experience the stomach rising and falling as impermanent, chaotic, unpredictable. The foot, they'll experience the movements of the body and so on. They will see this with complete clarity, or else they will see suffering, they will see the stress and clinging, they will see that the nature of the experiences is not worth holding on to, not of any value whatsoever, and they'll let go. Or they'll see a non-self, they'll see the stomach rising and falling on its own accord, they'll see the foot moving, the body moving, and they'll see that these things are not really me or mine. They'll let go of the idea that this is something that I possess, and the mind will let go as a result. So there's this final moment that we're aiming for, and we aim there through the practice of momentarily seeing things clearly as they are, watching things arise and cease, and getting an understanding of how impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable experiences really are. This is right view. The second is right thought, and to some extent these go in order. So right thought, right view leads to right thought or right mental activity. As a result of having the right perspective, our mind changes. Our way of looking at things determines how we respond, how we interact, how we react to our experiences, and so how our mind behaves. Ordinary interactions with reality are dictated by greed and anger and delusion. An ordinary person will get upset and very much invested in the nature of experiences. But through the perspective of seeing things as impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable, the mind starts to become equanimous. It lets go of thoughts of greed, thoughts of anger, thoughts of delusion. And so on a conventional level, this means having good thoughts. An important aspect of our practice is to think good thoughts and to be thoughtful, to be considerate of others and to give rise to thoughts of goodwill, wishing other people to be happy, wishing for yourself to be happy, making determinations. A lot of the chanting that we do is as a reminder to ourselves or as a determination, the cultivation of right thought, where we have the right intention or the right inclination, rather than thinking about how valuable it would be to engage in worldly activities or worldly pursuits. We start to cultivate through right view, start to think that it would be much better if we were to focus our attentions on more spiritual affairs. And so our mind begins to cultivate right thought. But on a practical level, of course, it's the interactions on a momentary level, momentary basis with sensual experience or with sensory experience. So when at the moment of seeing, right thought means having the right response to seeing, that seeing is not good or bad or me or mine, but seeing. And so this is why we engage in this practice of reminding ourselves with this, what is called noting, but really is the reminding. When you see something, you remind yourself, this is seeing, because you're trying to cultivate this clarity and this purity of thought. You want to have this moment of right thought where you see seeing as seeing, hearing as hearing, pain as pain, thought as thought, and so on and so on. Even seeing your reactions as what they are, seeing anger as anger, greed as greed, slowly untangling all of the connections and the reactions and the triggers that exist inside of us that lead to habits of unwholesomeness that lead to stress and suffering. So right thought is this practice of untangling the mind that comes from having the right perspective. Once you look at things the right way, you can start to put in the work to cultivate this right frame of mind where the mind is clear and aware and seeing things as they are, which of course is what ultimately leads us to see the three characteristics and to see that nothing is worth clinging to and that happiness is better pursued through letting go than holding on. As a result of those two, the next three are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And these ones don't really go in any particular order, though you could say that right speech is more primary. What you say and how you talk will affect how you act, but it's not quite so clear. To some extent, right speech and right action are a pair, and they just go together. But right speech, on a conventional level, means not saying wrong speech, not lying to other people, not having harsh speech, saying nasty things or insulting other people, not gossiping or speaking bad about other people behind their backs, not trying to ruin someone's reputation, trying to create animosity by gossiping about other people, and not engaging in useless speech, frivolous speech, speech about useless affairs, speech about politics or worldly endeavors, worldly affairs, sensual pleasure, and so on. Talking about food, talking about music, talking about entertainment, and so on. All of these things on a conventional level are essential for the cultivation of spiritual practice. A meditator should speak as little as possible and speak only what is necessary and what is valuable and what is important, what is true, what is beneficial and what is timely, and if possible, only what is well received. So trying not to speak something that is unpleasant to the person hearing it. But most important, speak what is true and beneficial. On a practical level, in terms of the practice of mindfulness, though, it really is right speech and right action and livelihood as well are really kind of just technicalities. Because at that point, the great thing about mindfulness practice is that so much of the wrong things that could arise have no opportunity. So there's no opportunity for wrong speech during the practice of mindfulness, obviously, because there's no opportunity for speech whatsoever. But more importantly, there's no potential for even desiring to speak, because your mind is occupied in a very wholesome and pure way. When you're focused on the experiences in front of you of the body and the mind, there's no room and no opportunity for any kind of speech to arise, especially unwholesome speech, because the mind has no potential for the arising of it, no inclination. Even if an opportunity to speak arises through the cultivation of mindfulness, the speech that does arise will be quite pure. There's no potential, because the mind is just seeing things as they are. There's no judgment, no liking or disliking, no reaction. So in the practice of meditation and mindfulness, speech isn't something you have to worry about during the formal practice, obviously. But what makes it so great is that all of the pollution that might come from speaking is not possible. All of the pollution that might come from acting is also not possible. But particularly with speech, so much stress and so much distraction, so much mental proliferation comes as a result of speaking to others. You feel worried about what you said, thinking about what you said, listening to others speak and thinking about what they said really gets you caught up in a real tangle. And so mindfulness as an activity is something that, just by its very nature of not inclining towards speech whatsoever, and more importantly, not inclining towards unwholesomeness whatsoever, has a real profound effect on the person's psyche. Your mind is given the opportunity to be very focused and very pure, because you're not distracted by the words that you have to say to others or the interactions, the conversations that you have with others. With right action, of course, on the conventional level, there's the absence of wrong action as well, not killing. You know, a meditator should engage generally in ethics on at least a very basic level, absolutely abstaining from killing living beings, from stealing, from taking what isn't given, from sensual misconduct, adultery or cheating or that sort of thing, lying, false, oh no, sorry, that's the others, just those three. You can say taking drugs and alcohol as well. Abstaining from wrong action, not wrong speech, as we've already been through. But in terms of the practice of mindfulness, right action takes on a more profound meaning, where we think of right action in terms of any action that is instigated purely by clarity of mind and wisdom, rather than by unwholesome intentions. So in meditation, it's true, it's clear that there's not much opportunity for speech in formal meditation, but in formal meditation there is still the opportunity for action. There's still the action of walking. There's even the action of sitting as an action, or observing the breath as breathing as an action. You know, there still is physical experiences, physical phenomena arising. And so mindfulness gives us an example of how valuable it is to have right action. So as you do walking meditation, you come to experience what it is to do something with a pure mind. And you can then extrapolate this and see how this is easily adapted towards any part of your daily life. When you're cooking, or when you're cleaning, or when you're working, or when you're exercising, anything that you do in your ordinary daily life can become meditative. And you see the contrast between doing something with, say, greed or anger or delusion, with strong emotions that lead to stress and suffering, and also lead to less efficient activities or less accurate activities that lead you to make mistakes, that lead you to cause injury even. Much of our injury is caused by lack of mindfulness. When we're not mindful doing something, we can easily make mistakes, harming ourselves physically or creating substandard products in our work or our studies or that sort of thing. And so you see the immense benefit on a worldly level and on a spiritual level from being careful about how we act, how we do the things that we do. And you find, as a result of the exercise of cultivating mindful walking and mindful sitting, that you learn how to engage in the world and act in such a way that is pure. This is right action. Of course, as with right speech, right action, at the moment of enlightenment, they're just a technicality. At that point, the mind is so pure that you could say that technically you have the best sort of speech and the best sort of action, because it's absolutely incapable of any sort of impurity. There's no possibility of any sort of impure speech or impure action. For right livelihood is on a conventional level based on right action and right speech. So if you are engaged constantly, consistently, perfectly in right speech and right action, then right livelihood is not something you have to worry about on a conventional level. It's still worth mentioning, because it's a part of conventional life. We have to consider the work that we undertake, or we have to consider that with the work that we might be required to undertake. If you take on a job of some sort, you have to understand what are the consequences, what are the expectations, whether you're going to be asked to kill or asked to steal or asked to lie or asked to cheat or asked to engage with drugs or alcohol or that sort of thing. On a practical level, of course, in a meditation center, livelihood isn't really an issue. At this point, we're not really concerned with making money or even concerned with the necessities of life. They're provided to us. We're given food, we're given shelter. As monastics, we're even given medicines and robes. We're given all of the necessities by the people in the village and so on, by our supporters. So livelihood isn't something we have to think about on the same level as ordinary life. But as a meditator, livelihood means the engagement with the requisites, with the requirements, with the objects that we need to sustain ourselves. So engagement most directly, most obviously, with food. And every day we have to intake food. It's something that, of all the things that we can give up to come here and live in the forest, we can't leave behind our need for sustenance. And so food is something we reflect carefully upon. The moment of eating, we can be mindful of the tastes and of the experiences of the food. This is an important part of our practice, acknowledging that it's something that we have to engage in, something that has to take us away from the pure practice of formal meditation. So we have to be conscious of our need for food and our need to partake of food. The need to partake of sleep is another one. So we have a residence, we have a bed, we have a room, we have a place to sleep, and so we're mindful of our dwelling place, mindful of our resting place, not taking it for granted or not becoming attached to lying down, attached to the comfort. As monastics, we try to live simply, and we try to sleep and dwell in simple dwellings for this reason, because we understand as something that we need to undertake, it's easy for this to distract us or to become a source of disturbance to our practice as we get attached to the pleasures of comfortable lodgings and comfortable bedding and so on, that sort of thing. So right livelihood, also in terms of how we seek out or how we receive the things that we receive, so the reception of food, that we're mindful of it, then we don't take it for granted, and that we appreciate the food that is given to us, we appreciate this dwelling that is given, the monastery and the meditation center that is given to us, and mindfulness in terms of using it properly and using it respectfully and caring for it. And we ask the meditators to engage and to partake in keeping the place clean and organized and so on for this reason, just to help us appreciate and use these things wisely. Of course, at a deeper level in the practice of meditation, livelihood isn't something either that comes up. It's something that you can be said to have already perfected as a result of just staying in the present moment, not being distracted by anything, let alone food or shelter or any of those things, because you see them just as experience. Tasting is just tasting, feeling is just feeling, and so on. So those three are the three in ethics. The sixth aspect of the Eightfold Noble Path is right effort. And so now we get into the more meditative side of things. Right effort on a conventional level is the effort to undertake the practice of meditation, among other things. It's the effort that we undertake just to come to a meditation center, but on a day-to-day level, it's the effort that we undertake to do good things, to be kind, to be thoughtful, to be generous, the effort that we undertake to be ethical, the effort that it requires us to not give in to our desires to do things that are going to harm our practice, and the effort that it takes just to do the meditation practice, to get up early in the morning, to stay up late at night, the effort to get up and do another round of walking, the effort to stay seated, the effort to stay focused, the effort to incline the mind out to experience the object. The effort that we take just to come here and to be here and to do what we're doing is not something insignificant, something worth appreciating and something that we have to not take for granted. Every day we have to apply ourselves. But on a more fundamental level, on the level of the experiential reality, effort is the aspect of the practice where we incline the mind in the right way. That the mind will, at any rate, experience and react to our experiences as a matter of course. Every moment that we see and hear and smell or taste or feel or think, there is an interaction with the mind. Effort is the guidance of the mind. Of course, we can't stop ourselves from experiencing certain things. We can't even stop often our reactions. But the effort to change things about ourselves, this is the effort to change our perspective, is a very essential part of what it means to practice mindfulness. So when we apply ourselves, reminding ourselves that seeing is just seeing, hearing is just hearing, pain and so on, they are what they are, reminding ourselves using the mantra, using a word, just to remind ourselves of what the experience is. This is the cultivation of effort. This takes a certain amount of effort. And there's effort involved as we retrain the mind, because the ordinary, if we let the mind go, the ordinary way of the mind is to judge, to react, to like certain things, dislike certain things, and it's like a cork bobbing on the water, being tossed and turned by the waves. If you just let your mind go, it just really doesn't seem to go anywhere. Liking this, disliking that, with no real rhyme or reason, judging, reacting, sometimes good, sometimes bad. You can't just let it go, because it has no true direction. When we cultivate mindfulness, the greatness of it is you don't have to have some kind of view that this is right or this is wrong. You just have to try and see things as they are, and that is right. There's no question that when you see things as they are, that's much better than not seeing things as they are. Not understanding the nature of things. Is this worth holding on to? Is this worth chasing after? Is this worth developing and so on? You don't have to ask these questions because you can see for yourself. Mindfulness is the process of coming to see things, see the nature of things for yourself without having to judge or have any preconceived notion of what is good and what is bad. So the effort to remove unwholesomeness and to prevent it from arising, the effort to cultivate wholesomeness and to guard it when it has arisen, these are the efforts that go on in the practice of mindfulness. That you're cultivating wholesome clarity of mind and you're guarding it. There's effort involved. Every moment that we practice, guarding our practice, keeping the mind focused on the cultivation of the practice. The seventh is right mindfulness. And of course, right mindfulness is the essence of our practice. On a conventional level, mindfulness is not really what we're teaching here, but something that is, of course, already taken for granted, that you should be mindful of things like the time. Is it time to come for reporting so that you don't miss your appointment? Mindful of things that have happened in the past so that you don't repeat your mistakes. Or mindful of lessons that you learned so you can build upon them. Mindful of the future. Mindful of what you have to do so that you can prepare for it. And also mindful of what is coming so that you can prepare for it. Mindful of old age, mindful of sickness, mindful of death, mindful of the inevitability of things that are going, you're going to have to reckon with, you know, that you're going to have to face the inevitabilities of life. And so mindfulness of these things is valuable. Mindfulness of conceptual things like mindfulness of the nature of the body as unpleasant, unbeautiful, you know. Whereas we're constantly taught to make our bodies beautiful and to cling to the bodies as something beautiful or attractive. Mindfulness of the unattractive nature of the body can be quite valuable in terms of helping to change that attitude and helping to change that distortion of perception. Because there's nothing really beautiful about the body. It's full of unpleasant, unattractive material. But this is really just conventional. It's in ultimate reality, there's nothing disgusting about experiences. They just are seeing or hearing or smelling or tasting or feeling or thinking. So on a practical level, mindfulness should be very familiar with you already. It's just mindfulness of the four foundations, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of experiences in the present moment. Not conceptually mindfulness of the body, but in an ultimate sense, mindfulness of the physical experiences. When the stomach rises, mindful of that as an experience. This is rising. When the stomach falls, falling. Mindfulness of pain as pain. This is pain. mindfulness of thoughts as thoughts and emotions as emotions and so on. This is very should be very familiar. There's not a lot that needs to be said. Until finally, at the last moment, right mindfulness is this last moment where you just see things, you grasp objects with such clarity, the mind will come to a level of equanimity that is able to experience every moment of experience just for what it is. Whereas before you would have noticed any liking or disliking, eventually the meditator comes to see no experience of liking or disliking, that every experience of seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and feeling and thinking is equanimous, without any judgment, without any reaction. There is this grasping, mindfulness is the ability to grasp something properly, just as it is. Not wrongly grasp, like when you grab a knife by the blade, this is the wrong way of holding on to it. When you hold something correctly, this is like grabbing the handle. When you grab it, it means you grasp, you understand it, you focus it, your mind is in focus and you see it just as it is. This is right mindfulness. This is the moment that we're cultivating. And when you reach that moment and just see nothing is worth clinging to, then there's the experience of cessation. The eighth quality is right concentration or right focus, samma samadhi. And so on a conventional level, this means staying focused on the practice, focused on what's important, not getting distracted or sidetracked, or this is getting caught up in conversations or getting caught up in activities that take you out of the practice. That's why we tell them, why we require meditators not to engage in entertainment or distraction or communication with the outside world and all of these, because obviously these are the sorts of things that detract from our ability to focus, our ability to concentrate. Concentration is the focus of the mind that comes from holding things. When mindfulness holds something, concentration is the result. It's the final of the eightfold factors, because it's what comes from being mindful. On an experiential level, there's two ways to cultivate concentration. You can cultivate it first. So some of the Buddha's teaching is dedicated to the cultivation of tranquility as a practice, to get yourself ready to see things as they are. And so you can cultivate it based on a concept. You can cultivate it based on an image in the mind, or a color even, or an idea in the mind. You can cultivate tranquility based on an emotion like kindness or compassion towards other beings. These are the kinds of things that calm the mind and focus the mind. They lead to a great stillness of mind. So these kinds of practices are not what I've been talking about here in terms of being the practice which leads to enlightenment, because they don't, because they're preliminary. They can be used as a means of creating great states of tranquility and calm, but they have to then be followed up by the cultivation of these eight factors through the practice of mindfulness. The other way to cultivate is to simply begin to practice mindfulness with a distracted mind, with a restless mind, with a mind that is not tranquil. And this is perfectly valid as well, because the tranquility comes, and by the end of the cultivation of the eight factors, of course, there is the same sort of tranquility. This is what the Buddha called jhana, where the mind enters into a state of pure tranquility and clarity and happiness, in a sense, where the mind is happy, the mind is content. So meditators often are discouraged early on when they find that they're not able to experience this tranquility, this sense of peace. But they have to understand that in this practice, that is the goal at the end. The goal is to come to a state, as I said, where the mind is equanimous and as a result very focused and very tranquil, without any disturbance, feeling that the practice becomes more and more refined as one continues to practice. It's the cultivation of samma samadhi. Until finally the mind is perfectly in focus as a result of mindfulness, then there is this focus, this clarity, seeing the three characteristics and letting go, right concentration. So these eight factors, again, constitute really all of what we can understand to be the Buddha's teaching. If you want to have this most succinct and complete understanding of what is the teaching of the Buddha, you can understand that it is these eight factors. Eight, they can seem a little bit overwhelming when you have to, when you get the idea that you have to somehow reflect on all of these or incorporate all of these manually into your practice. But as I said, that's really only on a conventional level. It can be quite valuable to hear about these things and even to think about them from time to time. Remember that certain things you might be engaged in are contrary to these eight factors. But on the ultimate level of the cultivation of mindfulness, you don't have to pay attention particularly to any one of these. Through the cultivation of mindfulness, you're also cultivating all of these eight factors. As I've tried to lay out, the practice of meditation based on experiences, focusing on the experiences, reminding yourself of the true nature of the experiences as they arise, all of these eight factors, as I've tried to explain, come into being. And so our understanding of these eight factors really just serves to support our understanding and our focus and our dedication to what we know to be the right practice. As we can see from these, in these eight factors, that there's nothing that is overly burdensome in terms of believing and in terms of belief or taking a leap of faith. All of these eight factors in terms of, or as factors of making, that make up a religion, are all things that we can easily agree are valuable and beneficial, and yet something that are unique and intrinsic to the practice of the Buddha's teaching and the cultivation of mindfulness. So something for us to keep in mind, obviously something incredibly valuable, something that can support and help our understanding and help guide us in our cultivation of mindfulness. So that's the Dhamma for today.